Okay, well, Jason, why don't you get started, and I'm going to get some more people in the room.
Okay, so this is a two-part talk that I have and question and answer period that I have planned on why defeating Russia or helping the Ukrainians defeat Russia is in America's self-interest. So in this first part, what I intend to do is I have one purpose in this first part, and that is to categorically establish why Russia is not just an adversary, Russia is an enemy of America. Therefore, it's in our national self-interest to defeat Russia. And if we can defeat Russia through a proxy like Ukraine, it's fine. And then in the second part, that's towards the end of the month, I intend to show why America, as the creator of the international liberal order that started after World War II, is in America's national self-interest to create that liberal order, of which Russia is not a part, can never be a part, at least not under Vladimir Putin. So this is less about helping Ukrainians and more about destroying Russia. And as I said, if it can be done by proxy, and if we can use the Ukrainians to assist in this endeavor, then more power to us. But we need to also, and I'm going to make a huge point of this, we need to destroy not just the regime of Putin, but to punish through ruthless, I think, brinkmanship, the average Russian citizen who put him in power in the first place and have kept him there by goading his rapacious cultural nationalistic expansionist policy. Many of the Russians themselves are even more culturally nationalistic, expansionist, and rapacious, and dream of reclaiming a great holy mother Russia more than Putin himself. We know that sanctions will not hurt Putin personally, so they are there, really. Sanctions are there to hurt the people, as they should. When enough has become enough, they will find a way to rid themselves of Putin. So I refer to the Russian people who put him there in the first place, have kept him there as Putin's willing executioners. They are killers by conviction. But first, I must show why Putin and Russia is our enemy and why it is a national security threat to the United States. And why strategically it's important to help any semi-free country engage in a war against Russia that Russia has initiated to win that war unprovoked. It's in our interest to do so. So the first proof that I would like to draw attention to is that the Russian government interfered in the 2016 US presidential elections with the goal of harming the campaign of Hillary Clinton. And boosting the candidacy of Donald Trump, and thereby increasing political and social discord in the United States. This has been ratified by the US intelligence community. The FBI's work taken over by 2017 by former FBI Director Robert Mueller, who led a special counsel investigation until March 2019, he concluded that the Russian interference was sweeping and systematic and that it violated US criminal law. He indicted 26 Russian citizens and three Russian organizations, and the investigation also led to indictments and conviction of Trump campaign officials associated Americans on unrelated charges. So the special counsel's report made public in August of 2019, examined numerous contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. It did conclude that the Trump campaign welcomed the Russian activities and expected to benefit from them, but there was, of course, insufficient evidence to bring conspiracy or coordination charges against Trump or himself. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about what is so nefarious and evil about interfering in the campaign and why that ought to be interpreted as an act of war against the American people. The second way in which Russia has shown itself to be an enemy of the people is that there is new evidence that show that Russia interfered also in the 2020 elections to support President Trump's re-election, while also meddling in the Democratic primaries to help Bernie Sanders. And this is coming from the Brennan Center for Justice, that there were all sorts of Kremlin-linked companies behind the influence that targeted the 2016 elections, that also targeted the 2020 elections. There's a team called Project Data Digital Ad Tracking Analysis that came up with some very, very startling conclusions that showed that Russian interference in the 2016 and 2020 elections had taken down about 75,000 posts from Facebook and Instagram and replaced them with Russian bots. This is just skimming the iceberg. So for me to go through this report would take up way too much time. So I would just encourage people to look at the Brennan Center report. The other proof that I would advance to show that Russia is an enemy of the United States is that Russia, according to the cybersecurity report issued by the Department of Justice, Russia has carried out 20 years of cyber attacks against the United States of America. And we all are, of course, aware of the recent cyber attacks against 18,000 public and private sector users of SolarWinds Orion Network, the Texas-based company, which allowed Russia to hack into Microsoft, Intel, Cisco, the Treasury, Justice, the Energy Department, the Pentagon, and paradoxically, or one should say ironically, CISA, the Cybersecurity and Security Agency that is designed to prevent these sorts of things from happening. So there have been a consistent pattern of cyber attacks that Russia has inflicted against the United States since Vladimir Putin. One could say before that, but we have proof, categorical proof, of cyber attacks against our institutions, against private companies, initiated by the Putin regime. In 2008, a Russian hijacking group called Turla began attacking military systems using deception, backdoors, root ticks, and infecting government websites. And this is all coming from the Russian Justice Department. Okay. So those three I offer, I'm going to offer some more in part two, but those three I think are enough to establish that our allies don't do those sorts of or commit those sorts of actions against us. And I think the violation of our electoral process is a declaration of war because it is an invasion into our sovereign and autonomous sphere with the willful intention to compromise and sabotage the informed intentions and will of the people. Our freedom of conscience and the concomitant judgment and actions proceeding from that faculty, the right to conscience gets thwarted. Therefore, the sovereignty and the ownership we have in our person is in a deep manner expropriated by a foreign power. I think they're on the same moral standing as the January 6th insurrectionists, many of whom are facing trial and some have been sentenced. So Russia, I think, has to be punished. So we could start with the least punitive and work our way up to what I call the hierarchy of annihilation. So one thing that can be done is to, and we've already seen this occurring this week with the leaders of both Sweden and Finland, who have said that Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin and Sweden's Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson, who said that everything changed when Russia invaded, and Finland and Sweden will now be seeking membership in NATO, is to expand NATO eastward, right? So one of the greatest shibboleths, I think, that has existed is that NATO's expansion is the cause of Putin's discontent. In fact, way before NATO existed, going back to the 19th century, Russia had an autocrat, it had repression, it had militarism, had suspicion of foreigners and the West. This is a Russia that, you know, according to the Stalinist expert, whom I love reading his work, Stephen Kotkin, has said, this is a Russia that we know. And NATO is not a militaristic expansionist phenomenon. It is a defensive phenomenon that is meant to protect the Baltic states and Europe in general from expansionism. So one could say that NATO expansion has put us in a better place to deal with this historical pattern in Russia that we're seeing today. Where would Poland be? Where would the Baltic states be were it not for NATO? So one way to sort of corner the bully and to surround him is to do exactly what Sweden and Finland are in the process of doing. That is that is pushing NATO eastward. Is to expand NATO membership to those countries that want it and that meet the various criteria. NATO has never threatened Russia, right? It acts as I said, a defense against Russian aggression. And now, as a result of its threats against Finland and Sweden, it has threatened, Putin has threatened Finland and Sweden that if it dares to join NATO, he will come after them, right? So they'll be seeking membership. The second way of sort of defeating Russia is to doubly increase the sanctions. That is, we've already banned Russia from the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, SWIFT, crippling its ability to trade with most of the world. I would say we continue along that route. But the most punitive sanction is technology transfer. That is, let's starve them of all high tech, that is encouraging, forcing the Commerce Department to deplete and deny Russia of American software equipment and to have an enforceable mechanism that can create a sort of technological wasteland in that country and hurt the regime and its people, his willing executioners. And I think that these sanctions, if accompanied by a sort of like a tariff relief vis-a-vis our allies, will bring the Russian people and those who support him and his policies to what I call using a strategic strife and concomitant backlash. I would say that we also bring on the MiG fighter jets, send as much aid to Ukraine, and commit as much troops along every threatened border in Ukraine. Let us hope that Biden can do what Kennedy did in 1962 when he faced off Khrushchev and eyeballed him down. And the Soviet government basically said, we will give... So we have given a new order to dismantle the arms, which you described as offensive, and to create and return them to the Soviet Union. We need to, I think, divest ourselves of this notion that all these actions that we will take against Russia will bring about World War III and that Putin will go nuclear on us. He's not crazy. He's not on a suicidal mission. He wants glory, power, and he wants his empire back. So I think tougher sanctions on Russia and on the energy companies are very important. When you look at the revenue numbers that Putin received last year versus this year, just astronomical. All that money goes towards killing the Ukrainians. We should either punish, I don't think we can punish our allies, but we should also either reprimand Germany very seriously for making their Nord Stream 2 deal in 2018 with Germany quite obvious for the repercussions that we're seeing right now. They kind of got a little bit too intimate. It kind of sold out, got too intimate with Germany. Fortunately, we are not in that position. In 2019, we became a net exporter of all oil products, including both refined petroleum products and crude oil. So we could help out our European allies in that respect. And in fact, the White House did announce on March 25th that the United States will rapidly increase its exports of liquefied natural gas to Europe as Germany and other European unions try to diminish their dependency on Russian fossil fuel, and that by 2030, the U.S. plans to send 50 billion cubic meters of gas to Europe directly. So those are some of the remarks that I wanted to make. Let me see if I have any more, because I've been talking for 15 minutes. I want to have there be enough time. I just cannot emphasize how strongly it is to regard Russia as an enemy when the evidence is there that it did interfere in our elections. This is part of what Russia, this might not be any of our business, one could say, but it is when Russia has as its manifest destiny to go around undermining democratic elections around the world. It has done so in other democracies. And one could sort of systematically, I could do this in another talk, systematically show the countries in which Russia has nefariously interfered in democratic elections and how this could interfere with our national security interests vis-a-vis those countries. But we'll stick for now and just show that interfering with the autonomous will of a people, the American people, is a declaration of war against this country. You don't do that sort of thing and with impunity and expect to get away with it. The other thing that I wanted to say to wrap up in closing is that Stephen Kotkin makes a very interesting point when he says that for, I'm going to quote from his, from one of his articles. He says, for half a millennium, Russian foreign policy has been characterized by soaring ambitions that have exceeded the country's capabilities, beginning with the reign of Ivan the Terrible in the 16th century. He says, Russia managed to expand at an average rate of 50 square miles per day for thousands of years, eventually covering 1/6 of the Earth's landmass. And you go on to this, and you go, so this is the question that was asked of him and by David Resnick. And David says, you go on there to describe fleeting moments of Russian ascendancy, first during the reign of Peter the Great, then Alexander the First, victory of Napoleon, then Stalin's victory. And this is, according to Kotkin, part of Russia's mythology as itself, as an invincible great power that cannot be shackled, by any institution, by any sort of regulatory body, such as we find in the EU or we find by NATO. And what you have in power, he thinks, is, and I agree, I concur, is a despot making decisions completely by himself, who does not think of Ukraine as a real country or the Ukrainian people as a real people, but as one with the Russians. So there's more that I could say about, and maybe this will come out in the question and answer period, because I don't want to take up too much time talking, but I am serious. Someone said to me in an interview that I gave recently about this topic, the Russian people are lovely. The Russian people are wonderful. And I said, yeah, I'm sure a lot of them are. I just don't know too many wonderful people who elect a despot and a tyrant and a rapacious expansionist, keep him in power, whose ratings actually went up tremendously when he began the invasion and the war against the Ukraine, who know, and I'm not buying any of this propaganda nonsense, who know exactly what his expansionist ambitions are all about, because they themselves harbor such impulses and goals and aspirations to recreate the Soviet Union, they themselves don't respect the borders of the World War II, the borders that were drawn after World War II, but even the borders prior to World War II, which would put Poland at great risk. So I think that part of, I understand why President Biden has to go on TV and say to the Russian people, this has nothing to do with you. I, as a philosopher, as a public intellectual, don't have to abide by that kind of silly rhetoric. All sanctions are geared towards hurting an economy, and it's always the people who are hurt. And in this case, I think the Russian individuals, the Russian citizens who support Putin are psychically infantile and have not achieved any semblance of political maturity. And before they can be brought within the crucibles, I would think even of civilizational maturity, if you're going to, any citizenry that chooses to elect a despot and an autocrat and keep him in power is not a citizenry, I think, that has achieved any modicum of political maturity, let alone civilizational maturity. And so the idea that we have nothing against the Russian people is a bunch of malarkey, in the same way that although Hitler was barely elected to the Reichstag, we still in some sense realize that the German people were responsible for the Nazi, the tragedy spawned by the Nazi regime. All right. There's much more that I can say. There's much more that I think, but I will stop here.
Yeah, I have a few questions.
Fourth in line. So yeah, we've got a few others in front of you. But thank you for raising your hand. I want to encourage others in the audience. Please jump in, ask questions, share your thoughts, agree, disagree. Please do so respectfully. One of the things that's unique about the Atlas Society is we welcome and embrace open debate and discussion. This is actually a topic where our scholars are not in a uniform agreement. So we are going to be having other forums, both here on Clubhouse as well as on our weekly webinar lineup to kind of air those different perspectives. But first, I'll get to my partner here, Clubhouse partner, Scott.
Hi there. Good topic. Thank you. Just a quick question, just from a practical perspective, even if, I remember Obama saying 10 years ago that Bashar Assad's days are numbered and, he's still in power. And so, just from negotiating, is it best to say that regime change is our goal, because then, there's no incentive for him to ever negotiate with us?
Well, I don't know that it would be prudent to announce. I think critics of that notion are correct. I'm not sure that it would be prudent to actually announce that regime change is. I think we can act secretly and operationally as if regime change is our goal. I don't know if it's prudent from an intelligence point of view to go around stating that. I think that's just not prudent for a number of reasons, but we can certainly, on the basis of, in a military fashion and from an intelligence point of view, go around doing that. I've been doing, a lot of rethinking about what constitutes extrajudicial killings, and it violates international law, but there is something to be said. And of course, it would not be in the interest of the United States to talk about that sort of thing publicly, but that's also one option that could be investigated and pursued by the CIA and the intelligence organs of the US government. But no, it wouldn't be prudent for us to go about talking about regime change openly. We could covertly pursue such an operation or such an idea, but for various reasons, it's just not prudential for us to talk about it that way. I don't see what there is to gain from openly stating that we are seeking regime change.
Roger.
Yeah, so it's interesting to hear the different scholars from Atlas Society talk about this, because I've heard Richard, I've heard Rob, and now I'm hearing you, Jason, talk about this, and the opinions are wildly diverse. So I can't wait until you guys can share a stage and kind of hash out some of this stuff. But one of the questions that I have is, while I agree that Putin is a monster and his acts are just it's naked aggression, needs to be dealt with, I think these are pretty obvious things. The question is the how. And I think some of the things that you pointed out are not necessarily the ideas that come first to mind to me. And I would just think that looking at this, putting on my objectivist lens and saying that, what's in the rational best interest of the oligarchs, right? It certainly wouldn't be the collapse of Russia. And is there a way that pressure could be put on the power brokers rather than the average people that would be able to cause them to do regime change so we don't have to get our hands dirty in this mess? Because I think you and I would like the same thing. We would like to see these barbaric ideas that they have and the expansionist ideas that they have, checked. But there's also a part of me that's thinking, time is going to defeat the Russians because, just with their birth rates alone in 150 years, there won't be any Russian people. And so this is just a mathematical equation of, they don't have a birth rate to sustain. They've got, 141 million people in Russia, and they've got a declining birth rate. Definitely by 2200, there is no more Russians. And I'm just wondering, is there a different way that we can hold things off by putting pressure on the oligarchs?
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive, right? So I think in the moral division of labor, labor can occur on multiple levels. I think you're right, though. It's not the Z generation in Russia that's out there waving patriotic nationalistic flags, calling for I think President Biden was right, the genocide. He used the word, I'm glad he upped the moral tenure of the language and used the word genocide. It's a genocide that's taking place. So I think that in the moral division of labor, work can be done on multiple levels. It's not an either or category. But I think that enormous pressure has to be placed on the Russian citizenry, the Russian people, for whom Putin is still a national icon. They've got to be retrained. They've got to be re-socialized the hard way. They've got to be broken down. They've got to be brought to the brink of absolute destitution. Then and only then will we see hopefully, some kind of internal change that either through a palace coup or through an outright revolution. But the notion of saving the average Russian citizen is not very, very high on my list, because the average Russian citizen is absolutely responsible for both the election and the maintenance of Vladimir Putin. So we are not just attacking, or we're not just saying that, I'm not just saying that the regime itself must be destroyed. I'm saying, just like what the Papa is saying, gasoline and alcohol just don't mix. Russia and the United States just don't mix. That country has to be brought, that has to be completely destroyed. Its political culture, that is, has to be completely destroyed and remolded before it can be inducted into the pantheon of the civilized union of European states. And it has to start, I think, ultimately with the citizenry.
Clark.
Yes. Professor, I just respectfully disagree with a lot of what you've said. So I would just start by saying that, 20 years ago, when W. Bush was president, Russia and the U.S. were allies. And, you know, Putin was famously the first foreign leader after 9/11 to contact W. Bush and offer his support. In fact, Putin wanted to have an alliance in a war on terrorism with the U.S. And in fact, Russian intelligence is what helped the U.S. in those first few months back in, and this is 20 years ago, of course. It was Russian intelligence that helped the U.S. do very well, at least in the beginning of the Afghan war 20 years ago. So and it was the U.S. actually that rejected Russia's friend request. In fact, in 2004, if you look at the specifics, the U.S. actually backed some Islamist forces in Chechnya. And of course, you know, as an old spook, Putin knew this. I mean, there's no way you can hide something like that from Putin. So I would just argue that, you know, this is a country that has 7,800 nuclear weapons. And you know, so you don't want to just gratuitously, you know, disrespect them. And that's basically what we've done. And of course, as other people have pointed out, you know, we basically pushed them closer to China and India and Iran, but by not basically dealing with them. Now, you know, maybe you don't have to be best friends with a country like this, but they do have those weapons. And you know, I mean, and they will use them. I think they definitely will use them if they feel threatened. And you know, you mentioned sanctions, and I could only just wrap up by asking you, when have sanctions ever worked to lead a people to overthrow their ruler? They didn't work in Cuba, you know, for 60 years. They didn't work in Iraq with Saddam Hussein. They haven't worked with in Iran. And actually, you know, sanctions, Putin is a very wily politician. He's managed to convince the average Russian voter, and I think this is why he's so popular, that the sanctions are the U.S.'s fault, not his. So the Russian people, since we've had pretty strong sanctions on Russia for at least 10, 15 years, I would say probably since the Georgia War of 2008. So Putin is a very wily politician. He's been able to convince the average Russian, and I think with some justification, that, you know, the fact that they're hurting economically, that's the result of the U.S., not him. So I guess I just don't know. All the people who want to use sanctions, I think most of them are Keynesians. That's kind of a Keynesian approach to foreign policy, sanctions and blockades and you know, currency manipulation. I just like, you know, when has that ever worked?
Well, sanctions never worked against Iran because, look, Iran and Russia are strategic partners, and Iran trades like hell with our European allies, which we should find a way of punishing our European allies for. Sanctions never worked in Cuba because Cuba, of course, I grew up 90 miles from Cuba. Cuba always had the patronage and the economic buffer of the Soviet Union. So until quite recently, and so sanctions never worked in Cuba because Cuba always had a bailout or a welfare, a massive big mama welfare state to take care of it. And China is always going to be there to buffer any kind of sanctions that we level against Russia. So another whole discussion has to factor around our next big adversary and enemy, which might not even be Russia, it might be China, and how we deal with China. So sanctions have never worked because we've never had the ability to sort of coalesce our allies, or to cajole or to force our allies into a unified, comprehensive agreement into not trading with those who are even their enemies themselves. So if you look at the Europeans, the deals that the Europeans have cut with Iran that have only helped to bolster their uranium projects, of course the sanctions are not going to work with Iran, when you have countries like Germany and France and so on trading. So the sanctions have to be done the proper way. And that's why I said, you know, we have got to somehow get our European allies to continue the sanctions against Russia, and not after 6 months or 7 months cave in. We've got to help them and keep them committed to their ideals. But sanctions can work if if consistently and properly applied. So Europe, Russia is an aging population. The people are used to hardships, but did you want to say something? So I think, I will just end here by saying that you're right, the sanctions that we have applied in all those cases didn't work because of an inability or an unwillingness for our own allies in Europe to not go along with us in the sanctions that we've applied against those countries that you pointed out to, like Iran. Cuba always had a buffer in the Soviet Union. And China is always there, that monster of a nation, to back Russia and to back Iran and other countries. So we also would have to have a separate discussion about how do we deal with China. We can't discuss sanctions. I agree with you. One thing I will agree with you on is that we cannot discuss sanctions against Russia without having a conversation about how to concomitantly deal with China, who is more than an adversary, is an outright enemy of the United States of America.
Arena, thanks for your patience.
No problem. Hi, thank you for inviting me to this stage. I just wanted to say how happy I was to hear everything that Professor said so clearly, especially about the responsibility of Russians. It's like a really huge topic right now in the Russian-speaking rooms where I am spending my time on Clubhouse. So basically, I completely agree with everything that Professor Hill said right now about breaking up Russia and about destroying completely Putin's regime. So that goes without saying. Also to add that a lot of people here on Clubhouse from Belarus, Kazakhstan, Chechnya, all the other countries around that are somehow under the influence of Russia, they're just waiting for their moment to break from Russia as well. And they are, most of them, even all Belarusians, are against Putin's regime and against what is happening now with Belarus as well. So that kind of goes without saying. But I was especially happy to hear somebody's very clear position on the responsibility of average Russians, because basically none of them is taking the responsibility for what's happening to them. Because they kind of argue that they don't have freedom of speech, they don't have, they have the threat of jail time and so on, so they cannot say anything, otherwise they will be jailed, and they cannot say anything. So even like, I don't know, this is like a $1 million question, how much, percentage-wise, how many people are against and how many people are for Putin, but probably the majority, as you said, the majority are for Putin. But even those who are against, they say, we don't take any responsibility, we don't have any responsibility, we refuse. The responsibility is on the West, and we cannot say anything, otherwise we will be jailed, and it's the responsibility of the West to deal with our regime. So we, as Ukraine, I'm actually Ukrainian, I didn't introduce myself, I'm Ukrainian, I live in Vienna in Austria, but I was born and lived in Ukraine for a long time, and all of the Ukrainians will be happy to hear what Professor Hill just said. We are all of the same position. So, and now we are all arguing somehow, like, who has, if the Russians have the responsibility or not. So thank you very much for your clear position on this.
Thank you, Arena. I've been enjoying seeing you in the audience in our discussions, and it's fun to have you come and join us up on stage. I hope it won't be the last time. And I will also go ahead and pin in this room the video that the Atlas Society did on My Name is Ukraine. And we're going to have the Ukrainian language version of that very soon. So thank you. Jacques, thanks for your patience. What an interesting profile you have. Jacques, do you want to unmute yourself? All right, he may have stepped away. Emma.
Hello. To what? I'm not sure how to pronounce your name. Irina, is that how? Thanks. To her comment about average normal Russian citizens' responsibility, I'm kind of confused to that, because if Putin is an evil dictator and he will put people in jail and, you know, have these repercussions for people speaking out, then we can't really blame normal average Russian citizens for not speaking out for fear of their lives, right? So I'm not sure if we should blame Russian people for not speaking out if Putin is this evil guy that will, you know, put your family, whole family in jail and all that stuff. And about sanctions, I'm just like Clark said, actually I came in when Clark was talking about sanctions and how they don't work. I feel like they not only don't work, they don't actually hurt the person you're trying to hurt. Like, Putin isn't going to be suffering. It's the normal average citizen that's going to be suffering. And they'll be thinking, well, why does the West, why does the United States want to punish us, the normal citizens? So I'm actually against sanctions, because it hurts the average person. They're the ones suffering, and not the people, the top 1% that are making the decisions. And there needs to be another way. If you want a regime change, then putting sanctions and hurting the average person. Thank you.
Well, you came in a little bit late, Emma, because I there are two responses I would have. One is, if he's such an evil person that stifles the rights of people, why is his popularity rating so high? Why did they go up exponentially after he invaded Ukraine and started a war? He achieved heroic status. So if he's going to put people in prison, and if he's going to, in some sense, jail them for dissenting, why keep such a man in power? And as I said, yes, the average citizen should be hurt to the extent that such an average citizen is a supporter of Russia. The sanctions are not meant to hurt Putin's pockets. He will not suffer. He will not be able to not buy bread and sugar and flour. It is the average citizen who put him there and has kept him there and will make sure that he remains in power till 2036 who should bear the suffering, who is complicit in every atrocity that he's inflicted in 2014.
Are you serious right now, holding the people responsible?
I am deadly serious as a heart attack.
That's what I don't agree with. You shouldn't
this,
hold people
this is
responsible.
Preposterous. Are you going to hold the American people for a million dead Iraqis and Afghanis? I mean, this is a terrorist tactic, Mr. Jason. I am very appalled to hear what you're saying. You're supposed to be an intellectual, sir.
Well, what are you appalled by?
I beg your pardon.
We were engaged in a war against the country, and we fought that war. And the purpose of a war is to win the war. Saddam Hussein has made serious threats against the United States of America. He was a cancer in that region. The war in Afghanistan was completely justified for various reasons. The way that war was fought was ridiculously fought, but we fought two justified wars.
Yeah, and is what Putin is doing. His war is justified against Ukraine.
No, it's not. No, it
yeah,
is
according
not.
To you, it's not.
According
but
to me, it's
to
not.
But you fail to see the perspective of the other side. That is your problem, and you lack intelligence because you cannot perceive the worldview of the other.
Look, I'm not going to allow you to take your sophomoric high school opinion and elevate them to human knowledge by assuming that I don't have intelligence. So we have to start this conversation at a different level, or, you know, you can't be a part of this conversation. So, yeah, goodbye.
Well, I'm not saying goodbye. I just, Jacques, moved you to the audience. I hope you will stay for this conversation, as well as some of the other conversations that we're going to have as Roger and as Clark and others have observed. There are different perspectives within the Atlas Society, and it's part of the principle that we uphold to air them. But we want to be respectful to all of our faculty, including Professor Jason Hill, who's put some work into his position and has thought deeply about foreign policy over the decades. And it's okay to disagree and ask questions, but let's try to do it so that we can all be heard. John Lang.
Hello. My question is a general one. I hear talk of sanctions quite often in discussions of foreign policy, and it's all very vague as to just what they are. And obviously they're different in different contexts and applications, but it's a little bit like somebody saying they're for free trade when they really mean, well, yeah, they're for free trade, but with the particular tariffs that we want to benefit this or that industry or harm this or that competitor. And the word sanctions is terribly ambiguous for me. And then there's the other aspect of it, which is, what does it cost us? I mean, is part of the problem with the weakness of the dollar the fact that we're running around applying sanctions all over the place? How much do they cost? I don't know what sanctions are. Thank you.
I did spend some time spelling out what I meant by sanctions. One of the most forceful forms of sanctions I talked about was technology transfer, starving them of high tech. That is denying them American-made software equipment and products, and that affects every important. And having an enforceable mechanism for doing that. So you sort of create a technological wasteland in Russia if you deny them American-made software, equipment, and products. President Biden just signed into law, by executive order, stopping the importation of Russian oil into this country. So there are specific sanctions that I discussed at the start of this talk. And I don't know that we go around the world imposing sanctions on everyone. One would have to get a little bit more specific about that. We impose sanctions for moral reasons. America usually does not arbitrarily or egregiously, gratuitously rather, go about imposing sanctions on the world. We do so usually for very specific reasons against our adversaries or against countries that betray our national interests by acting in a manner that are inimical to our self-interests. So, I had spoken earlier, which I don't have the time to repeat, about the reasons why sanctions hadn't worked against Iran and hadn't worked against Cuba.
Yes, my apologies, Jason, because I did join the discussion late. But my comments were really in general. When I hear discussions of sanctions, from the sort of State Department type of position, it's never hooked up to specific actions. Like, for instance, there are specific companies that are going to be hurt by what you just mentioned. That is, you can't sell your product into Russia. You may have had a contract already, and now you have to cancel it. Or maybe you're in the business of importing oil, and now you're harmed by it. I would hope that in the public discourse that there would be specificity attached to any reference to sanctions. It sounds good, but I don't know what it is. Thank you.
Right. Well, I'll just briefly say, of course, there are going to be harms done and it's going to be harmful, but, it in the same way that we don't commit treason, and I'm going to be very specific here, and I mean this quite seriously. If you're a business person and you wish to do business with an enemy of the state, then you relinquish your citizenship. You don't do business with an avowed and declared enemy of the United States of America while still enjoying American citizenship. That's an act of treason. as far as I'm concerned. You don't aid and abet the murderous impulses and homicidal impulses that a country has towards your own country. You can do so as a citizen of another country, but not under the protection of or under the within perimeter of U.S. citizenship.
I think the thing is, as Clark said, sanctions have not worked, say, in Venezuela either, and North Korea either. The regimes there are still intact. So if they don't work and they only hurt the people there, and we can all agree that North Korean people, they're innocent. Like, they did not elect Kim Jong-un, right? So why are we punishing those people? And just the leaders there, the 1%, are still doing fine. It's the citizens there that are dying of starvation.
Thank you, Emma. I did want to, in the 8 minutes we have left, get to a few other people who have raised their hands. So we're going to probably not be able to get to them all, but we'll give it a try. And this is the first part of Jason's two-part series. I'm also going to put the link up there to the debate / conversation we're going to be having among our scholars with different perspectives. So, Norm, you want to unmute yourself and chime in? Thank you.
Sure. Hi, thanks for the opportunity. I always enjoy hearing Professor Hill, and I think this is just a great opportunity to hear his thoughts. Obviously, Russia is a adversary and one to be watched with tremendous scrutiny, and one with whom we ought to deal very firmly. We don't have any alternatives besides sanctions that I can see. And I will share, and I'd be interested to hear what the response is, that I only wish that our president, President Biden, for whom I voted, I'm always quick to say, would have made it clear to Putin before all of this destruction that the Western world, that NATO, that Europe and the United States would respond to any incursion with devastating force, localized, not on Russia, but on any military incursion or any military invasion. I thought that's what Biden was doing in those famous phone calls in the weeks before the invasion, and I'm really sad that Ukraine has to endure this destruction and bloodshed. It's for nothing. No good will come of it. And I'd be interested to know if anybody agrees with me that that the assurance of a devastating force would have deterred Russia's invasion before it happened, just out of curiosity, because that's what I thought we were doing. That's what I expected Biden to do, and I'm sort of shocked that he didn't do that, and I'm a bit appalled at the sort of the firm but insufficiently strong, insufficiently aggressive, insufficiently devastating response that we've given. I'm really shocked to see what's going on there. Does anybody think that this could have been avoided with diplomacy or, you know, a really serious phone call with Putin before it happened?
Jason.
I don't think diplomacy works with this kind of person. I mean, this is a psychopathic bully. I think he should have been bombarded with the MiG jets, and we should have supported Poland in their efforts. We should have supplied Ukraine immediately with every single military configuration that was possible, And I'm going to go a step further and say that we should have amassed U.S. troops along the Ukrainian border in a massive and overpowering way. Ukraine is an autonomous, sovereign country. Russia has no business at all having any business to fear that any more than, let's say, we were threatening Canada and France jumped in and protected the Canadian border. We would be wrong to be threatening an autonomous state like Canada. So I think if we had just sort of bombarded the borders with U.S. troops, sent the fighter jets over to Ukraine from Poland, committed artillery ourselves from the United States to Ukraine, we would have shocked him, we would have scared him, and he would have backed down. There's no such thing. The Russians are bullies. Putin is a bully. And diplomacy just, I don't think, would have worked one iota with such a person. You have to act with force and with complete strength and with no sense of appeasement with someone like Putin.
You know, Jason, when people like you speak, I always wonder if they've actually been to a war zone or have been through any of that. It's very hypocritical to think that the U.S. are the police of the world, because if it was, if you actually cared about people and sovereignty and all of these things, there are so many countries for you to invade and defend and go to their borders and all of that. So please spare us that woke BS.
Okay, well,
first of all, it's not
along the lines of the respectful conversation.
Well, let me just address this. First of all, I am anything but woke. And yes, in the next talk I'm going to give, I am going to talk about the international world order that the United States created after World War II and why we do have a moral responsibility to police parts of the world. And it is in our national self-interest to do that. The only way I can spare you, the individual, of any of this, is for you just not to appear on the app. But don't speak on behalf of any other person about sparing them of anything. The United States sometimes does act as the police when policing parts of the world is in its national self-interest. And one can trace quite properly how policing certain parts of the world that has resorted to thuggery is in the interest of America. So there's nothing woke about what I'm saying. I am the last woke person you'd like to find on this app or any other app in Clubhouse.
So Jason, you're saying that you,
Actually, no, we're at time. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off, but we also skipped the line and we didn't get to Matt. So Matt, apologies for that. Thanks everyone for bringing your questions, your perspective, and your insights. This is the, as I mentioned, the first of two conversations on the subject that Professor Hill will be leading, but we are going to have next week a conversation with a diversity of perspectives on our faculty, including Professor Richard Salzman, who has been in the room but not able to speak for this session, and as well as Rob Trusinski, who shares to Jason Hill. So, and please check out that link above to join that conversation. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.